Hello, everyone. Given the 25 past 10, we may make a start. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the session on delivering practical innovation with artificial intelligence in insurance. I'm Vivian Yu. I will be your chairperson for this session. I'm very pleased to have the opportunity to introduce our presenter today, Dan Taylor. Dan is General Manager of Innovation at TAO, where he leads the innovation team, including TAO's Accelerator, Incubator, and the Data Lab. Dan has been at the front line of corporate innovation for the past 15 years and has developed and launched everything from digital payment technology to smart home products, and even founded some of his own business along the way. Surprisingly, Dan is also a published author, has written one of the very well-regarded books in this area, The Secret of Big Business Innovation. He has deep expertise in customer-led proposition design and delivering innovation in the corporate environment. In yesterday's plenary sessions, we got a glimpse of the artificial intelligence in action. Now, Dan will demystify artificial intelligence, and he will share with us his experience from utilizing machine learning in an underwriting and insurance chatbots. At the end of the Dan's session, please remember to complete short presenter survey via the Financial Service Forum app. Without further delay, please join me in welcome Dan Taylor.
Right, thank you. Good morning. I'm not sure I'll demystify it, but I'll have a go at hopefully sharing some of our experience. So first up, confession to make, I'm not an actuary or a data scientist, but hopefully I'm going to share some of the things that we've been doing at TAO, and hopefully that will give some insights into our journey on machine learning and AI, and hopefully there'll be some lessons for all of us. Now, I want to get to know you and your businesses a little bit first. So we're going to start, if I can get it to work, with some questions for you. So if you can get out your apps, assuming you've all got... Has everyone got the app? Excellent. There should be some pollings in there. So if you go to 6C... Oops. Where's the polls gone? There should be three questions in a row if I can find out how to put the answers up. Any ideas? Ah, you were doing this.
Well, Dan is working on this. Can you just go to the app and there is a polling? And we just can go start with the polling for questions 6A. Sorry, 6C.
The answer's vanished. Do you want to see if we can get them? Yes, just going straight to the presentation.
Yeah, but that's what you are. Sorry,
what? No, doing the polling.
The polling's at the end of the presentation.
No, it's at the start.
It's actually at the end of the presentation.
Ah, right.
You didn't come and see me, so I've just put in the end of the presentation. So if you look at the end, it's the last three slides.
End, it should go.
There's the
question. There we go. Thank you. Right, question one. Has everyone had a go at it? Okay, let's see how we're doing. You test things beforehand and they work and then they change. Right. Wow, a lot of talk. I see there's one or two TAO people in the audience, so hopefully they've got the right answer. Okay. Do you want to have a go at the second question for those that haven't already? Awful lot of talk. A few pilots, okay. Okay, interesting. So real focus that we're seeing both on manual tasks and also on helping us make decisions. So I'm not sensing a lot of worry about replacing humans, bit of interaction. Okay. And then let's just see the last question. If you can have a crack at that one as well, please. So that's looking at in the value chain where it might impact. Okay, you lot are confident. Lot's not going to hit actuaries, is it? Okay, really, really interesting. So we'll come back to that a little bit more later, but I think it's really interesting just getting a sense. There is an awful lot of talk. As I say, Tal, we're on our journey. We've made a start, but there is still a lot of talk, and there's a long way to go. And it's interesting to see the focus, a lot of customer service applications. I'm going to talk a little bit today around some chatbots and the way we're using those for customer service, and also in underwriting, which is another big focus. And again, I'm going to touch on that. So luckily, you've answered areas that I'm going to be talking about, so that's good. But we'll come back to those things perhaps later. So what I just do, I guess, is set the scene a little bit, because there's an awful lot of buzz about AI. You will have all have seen charts like this one. This is CV Insights. This one's actually from last year. But I've looked at the most recent numbers, and the picture is very, very similar. So it shows a picture of there's lots of fintechs piling into this space. There's startups, there's VC investment. And out of that, AI is the top one. So there's blockchain, there's Internet of Things, there's all these new technologies. AI is the big hotspot for all of them, for those investment. So it's absolutely a big focus for the industry, a big threat potentially. And it can mean a lot of things to a lot of different people. So some people will think of AI and think of Siri. For some people, it's about this brain, this machine learning that starts to think like us. For other people, they'll be thinking of manufacturing plants and cars where there's big robots that are acting and putting cars together, those sorts of things. So we need to be really clear around what we're talking about when we think about AI. Within insurance, certainly for us as a life insurance business, we're not going to be talking a lot about robotics today. My focus is more this thinking area of machine learning, which is where it probably interacts with underwriting quite a bit, and then some of these chatbots, which are particularly the talking end or writing end, and some of the technologies that are needed to do that. It needs to understand human language, okay? It needs to be able to read some of our documents sometimes. So we're going to talk very much today around those specific areas of AI. And also, for those still thinking about Siri and those sorts of things, that's effectively a general intelligence, which means you can ask Siri any question you like. Won't always know the answer, but it's trying to learn across pretty much every area of human knowledge, I guess. We're going to talk very much on narrow intelligence, artificial narrow intelligence, and that's where it's focused around one specific area of data, effectively. So where you train a machine around one specific focus set of data. So we're going to talk very much in those areas. Hopefully that's going to be useful to you all. So AI. When I go out and I talk to our stakeholders in the business, and indeed pretty much anybody, you mention AI and people's their eyes glaze over a little bit, and they start either talking about Skynet and Terminator or job losses pretty much. And this is a real challenge for us. People just don't understand it. And things we don't understand, we have a fear. And we've seen some of these crazy movies out there that kind of, in some ways, paint these great pictures of what the future might be like, but in some ways, they're really scary. And that fear is still pretty powerful in our businesses. People are always resistant to change, but something we don't even understand, this thing that can think like us but is kind of more intelligent in some ways, that's really weird. So what does AI mean for us in insurance? I guess the way I think about it is actually a lot of the benefits that can bring, and that's where we need to think about how we focus it. So yes, it can help things like targeting better experiences for customers and acquisition. It can help with tailoring our products from an actuarial perspective. We can think better about pricing and the product design. But ultimately, as I think about our role in the industry, it can actually help us prevent illnesses. So rather than a world where we're paying for events that happen, does it actually mean that we can identify, we can spot some of them in advance or the risk of them better, and therefore start to work on prevention strategies? Yeah, can we better understand the risks and therefore start to work to prevent them? And that's a very different mindset shift from us to trying to understand a risk and price it through to actually, well, beyond that, how do we start to prevent it? And I think there's a genuine shift in the industry. There's a lot of talk at this conference around mental health, for example, one of the big impacts, about the shift to prevention rather than just pricing of risk. And that's going to be a really interesting area as the industry moves forward. So some of this is a bit futuristic, and certainly when I talk about, I guess, the Terminator and Minority Report, it sounds pretty futuristic. But I guess I wanted to give an example of how this is actually real, how it's already happening today. And I'm going to use a very simple example from when I was watching a movie recently. I don't know what movie it was. It might have been this one. And I got that classic thing where you're 5 minutes in and you get this wheel of death, right? This wheel of death comes up. We all know that feeling of, well, the first thing you're going to do is go and turn the Wi-Fi router on and off, right, and see if you can get that to work, which is what I did. And the great news was 5-10 minutes later, whatever it is, I'm back watching the film. The film was actually fine. The thing about this story is, this was through Amazon Prime, which is effectively a Netflix-type service. By the end of the film, I checked my email, and I found that I had an email from Amazon. And Amazon sent me an email that said, we've identified that you had a problem viewing your film. I think they called it a movie. We've sent a refund to your account. Now, they have totally step-changed that frustrating experience of me being in a world where I had to get my film interrupted and spend 5 minutes mucking about with the router. It wasn't even their fault that my Wi-Fi didn't work. But they, artificially, there's no humans involved. This is, you know, a Saturday night, whatever it was. They have automatically noticed that the film's been interrupted. They've automatically processed that they could give a refund, and they've processed the money was already back in my bank account. That's an amazing process that's been done purely, effectively, by bots or automated decisioning. No humans involved. And it's actually transformed my experience. I'm here talking to you today about how brilliant that service and experience from Amazon was in what could have been a really frustrating experience. So when we talked earlier, you know, you highlighted that customer service is one of the areas where AI can start to change. I absolutely agree with you, and I think that's a great example where we're already seeing that. It's already starting to hit. Perhaps not necessarily, we're not quite there in some of the insurance yet, but that's an example from some of these leaders that are out there, the likes of Amazon, of how they're really implementing this. So this really is here, and it's very real. So in our industry... what are we going to do about that? How do we approach these challenges? How do we respond to this, not just this emerging technology, but all these new startups and the likes of Amazon and co. that are starting to have real impact on the industry? So first of all, we've actually hived off a specific team focused on this. So we have an accelerator, if you like, which is a very traditional innovation function, does all your human-centered design and your proposition development. And then we've created a team that we've called our incubator team, but that team is effectively a team with data scientists and so on in it to actually start experimenting and piloting with these technologies. The early focus is very much on artificial intelligence, but equally blockchain, all these others are on the list as well. So how can we start to step change the business with those? So I'm going to talk mainly about the incubator and the work that they've been doing, and perhaps it's worth just talking first around the way we've set that up, because it's quite important, going back to that point that I raised right at the beginning around no one understands it and stakeholders are pretty afraid of this new technology. So how do you start to introduce it to your business? So what we've done is we've created a totally ring-fenced team. So that means we've got rid of steering groups for this particular team. Now, I'm a fan of getting rid of steering groups anyway in the world of innovation. But nevertheless, for something like this, it's really important. As soon as you go out to engage the wider business, that's when you encounter all that resistance. It's when you get all those people asking questions that might be in the best possible intent for them to understand it, but the reality is it's going to really slow the process down. It's going to take you months and months answering these questions that don't really need to be answered. They're just trying to satisfy one individual stakeholder to get them comfortable that it's not necessarily going to impact them. So they're not necessarily trying to slow things down, but naturally they do. And that's why we've created effectively this team without steering groups. So they're directly empowered. We have a quarterly review with the CEO and the COO. Obviously, if we're actually launching anything, we have to go through the legal and that sort of stuff. But in terms of engaging the business, those sorts of things, for the purpose of piloting, we don't need to do that. We're going to go and experiment these technologies, make sure they work. Once they do, then absolutely we're going to have to go and engage the business. But to start with, something like this technology, we've absolutely got rid of that. The second thing we've done is think about the skills within that team. And I guess there was a big fad, it's still going on, but probably in the last year or two, everyone's hiring data scientists. Actuaries are changing their titles to data scientists, right? There's a lot of that going on. And yes, obviously data scientists are really important for this. But in order to really experiment and trial with this technology, you need effectively a cross-functional team, a team with all sorts of the right skills to be able to get these pilots out. So yes, we've got a data scientist. We've also got a data engineer to actually prep, make sure we've got access to the right data, that it's clean and all those sorts of things. And then we've got a team around that are customer, operationals, technical people who can actually put a pilot together. They can build tools, they can build chatbots, put them live with customers and see what works and see what doesn't. And yes, the data scientist is absolutely key, but it needs this team around them to be actually get pilots live. Otherwise, all you're doing is creating some PowerPoint and some models that may or may not work. The other thing we've done is we've incentivized that team to experiment and learn. So they're not incentivized around the success of any given pilot. They're incentivized around either proving or disproving any given hypothesis. So if we've got a hypothesis around, I don't know, a chatbot can improve NPS or whatever it is, that's the mission. It doesn't matter whether it does or it doesn't. It's about proving that so that we know, so that we learn. And that's been really important, enabling the team to give them the freedom to go out and try different things and understand what works and what doesn't. And then the last thing is to give them a really clear focus on what they're trying to achieve. It's very easy to get caught up in all the potential of AI and talk big visionary strategies or get lost in the complexity of all the data. And to my mind, you could easily spend 1, 2, 3 years, I don't know, very much like you guys talked about at the beginning in the poll, talking about it. There's a lot of talking that can be done in this space. But for us, we've been very deliberate in choosing some very discreet, very small, customer-focused products and services and projects where we think we can create a real impact. And again, going back to the hypothesis, test whether they work or whether they don't. And I think one of the reasons that we've done very well, which we'll talk about in a minute, is very much around taking what you might call the low-hanging fruit, those easy projects that you can get stuck into and get results reasonably quickly. And they're not necessarily trying to change the whole organization day one, but it's what they are doing is doing specific tests, as I say, around NPS or acquisition or whatever it may be. So what are the results of all of that? Where have we got to? What have we learned? Well, first of all, I'm going to talk about a couple of chatbots, get those out of the way with. First one we've launched is called Alfred. He's in our life broker business, which is a comparison business for life insurance. I'm not going to talk too much about Alfred. He's a chatbot. He gives you a quote. That's about it. You can book appointments with him. I'll talk more about the benefits of that and why we've done that. You can go into Facebook, onto Messenger, have a play with him yourself. He'll tell you a joke if you get bored. There are any dad jokes, so don't get too excited. But Alfred is definitely one bot that's been a really interesting experience for us. And then we've launched a very different chatbot in the claims space called Cora. And Cora actually came out of our employee innovation challenge, and it was an idea that talked about when we go out and we talk to people on claim, we find that they pretty much hit what we call a rut, where there's almost this depression, this sort of very difficult mindset around what this illness or what this condition might mean for them. Even if they might be recovering in 3-6 months in relatively quick terms, there's still all sorts of things go on in people's minds. And sometimes that could be very difficult for them to talk to people. Certainly, I went and spoke to a customer not long ago who was on claim, and it was a guy who was the sole breadwinner for his family, and he was off work. It was not necessarily that serious, but the interesting thing about it was that he suddenly felt really challenged in his role in the family. his role was this breadwinner, the guy who was going to bring the money home, look after the family, and he was very afraid that his wife, his kids, suddenly viewed him very differently in terms of his role and what he was able to bring. And he found it very difficult to talk to his family about that particular experience and the things that were going on in his head. So what he was looking for was other people that had been through similar experiences and that he could talk to were a sort of similarly that sole breadwinner and wanted to kind of, I guess, partly let out and vent and partly hear back and get some reassurance. It all makes sense when you hear it, but it's a bit strange. But on the back of that, we had this idea about creating Cora. And Cora leverages those that sign up to it, the experience of former claimants. So as TAL, we've obviously got thousands and thousands of former claimants who are similar people, who have been through similar experiences. And those that want to have been able to bring to this bot their experiences, their stories, their tips, their advice, so that they can share that with the right people. And it's what we've done is effectively the bot creates a way of interacting with people without necessarily that personal connection, because that can also be quite difficult for people. So there's a role here that the bot is really important, that you still feel a step removed, but you're still getting real benefit from real people through videos, through their stories, whatever. And likewise, you get the opportunity to tell your own story. So it's a really powerful thing both for claimants, and actually one of the surprises for us was for former claimants. They loved giving back. They loved telling their story, wanting to help others. And actually, as I say, whilst it's been great for existing claimants, it's actually proved to be one of the best things for former claimants and people who are coming to the end of their condition. So two very, very different bots there, each with their roles. And I want to talk a little bit around some of the things that we've learned from that. So we originally had these ideas that there's a whole new channel out there, that Facebook, everyone these days is doing messaging, and the apps are a thing of the past, which, when you look at the numbers, is true. There's a definite shift. I think there's something like 16 million active, and active means using it at least once a month, users of Facebook in Australia, 16 million. That's pretty big number when you think about our population. So user adoption is absolutely huge, and I'll come back to that point. It's potentially non-judgmental, and that's something that, as I described from the Cora story, is quite important. If you can find a use case that really takes advantage of the fact that people might be more inclined to tell the truth, and there's all sorts of reasons for that. One, they don't feel like they're being judged by a human. It might be if you've got a sales agent, that sales agent is incentivized to get a customer to go down a certain route. Actually, bots, obviously, you can avoid that. So there's nice instances of where bots can be really useful to get, I guess, more honest and open answers, potentially, from customers. It's not always true. There's obviously a knowledge and compliance angle. You know that a bot is always going to read the T's and C's in the right way. It's always going to go through the process consistently. And also, it's 24/7. It's an asynchronous, which I had to look it up in the dictionary, effectively means that you can start the conversation, go away, and come back again. So if you've got live chat, I don't know about you guys, if you use live chat at all, where you're actually chatting with someone in a call center or whatever, if you leave that conversation for more than 1 or 2 minutes, typically that's closed. And if you come back to it because you've got interrupted for whatever reason, I have kids, it happens a lot, then you have to start all over again. And that's a pretty frustrating experience. With a bot, you can leave it for 2-3 days and you can come back and it's still there. Not just that, the whole history's there. So you as a customer can see what the company has said and what you've said. So you can keep a really nice record of it as well. And it's 24/7, and that was one of the big benefits for us of Alfred. I talked about Alfred. One of the advantages for us was being able to have this chat interface 24/7, because our call center closes, I think it's 7 o'clock in Lifebroker, but a lot of people do their searches when they come home from work in the evenings or at weekends, so it's great to have an out-of-hours experience that's stronger than just the website, effectively. So again, think about the benefits of to where you can use bots. But you've equally got to look out for the pitfalls. For those of you who, depending on which Wikipedia page you read, I think humans have a shorter attention span than goldfish, apparently. I'm not sure how true that is. Don't even know how you test it. Nevertheless, the point is really valid, and the point is you've still got to be really quick and easy for people to interact with. So Alfred, which through Lifebroker, I think we just asked five questions for effectively that underwriting process. That still takes the best part of 3 minutes by the time people have been through it, answered the questions, checked the T's and C's, looked at their quotes, and potentially booked an appointment if they want more information with a sales agent. Now, so I get questions, why don't we put a chatbot into our full underwriting engine, those sorts of things. It's far too complex. You need really simple cases that are easy and quick for people to get on with and get done. Otherwise, they're going to get very frustrated, just like we all do. All you're doing with a bot is exposing the back-end processes. And if we expose long, difficult, bad processes, that's not necessarily a good thing. You've got to get the right process before you expose it. So do think very carefully around what you're going to use bots for. There's also something about personality. We, as humans, when we pick up the phone, we're speaking to an agent, we're immediately trying to build rapport and speak to them and try and get them on our side and get to what we want. How does a bot cope with that? A bot is a very, by its nature, typically a very robotic sort of thing that we interact with. And people can get very frustrated if you're not careful. So how do you, yes, there's natural language processing, and we've built that into the bots, but that still only goes so far. We've got Alfred telling jokes. That helps for people who are bored, frustrated, cheer them up, whatever. Does it really do everything? No. So you've still always got to provide an exit route. When people do get stuck, make it easy for them still to call an agent or have another channel to speak to. So bots are not this silver bullet that's going to solve all our process issues. You've got to have the right processes. You've got to then apply the bots to the right process, and you've still got to have alternate channels. So that's all I'm going to say on bots. And now I'm going to start talking about machine learning. And before I do that, I wanted to, talk a little bit around data. By definition, machine learning depends on lots of data. And there's an awful lot of excitement in the industry around all these new data sources that might be able to transform, our risk and our profiling. And there's, I won't go through this whole list, but there's some interesting ones on here. There's Google's distracted driver. So not only can they check our search history, but they can see we're driving at the time we're on the phone or texting. They know that. Yeah, that'd be quite interesting for not just car insurers, for life, health insurers, etc. There's all sorts of things that all these different companies can potentially have access to data for. And all of these things potentially in some future world are going to be great for where we can take insurance and our ability to profile risk and understand specific behaviours and segments. I think that's going to be huge potential. So what I do want to call out, though, is just some early ventures into that space, that it's not always that easy. The first one is actually from a few years back. I used to work at British Gas, which is the biggest energy utility in the UK. And we were rolling out smart meters, which are effectively, rather than you have to send an engineer around to read the meter automatically sends in all the data. Pretty simple stuff, but obviously that creates a huge amount of data. And actually the things you can start to read into that, because you can see by people's electricity usage when they're in and when they're out and all those sorts of things, potentially you can start to see what appliances are being used. So really interesting source of data. And British Gas were launching home insurance at the time. So they had this bright idea that we'd be able to profile risk based on the smart meter data, and actually we'd have an advantage over all of the other home insurers out there. So we collected the data, we crunched the numbers, did all those things. There was zero correlation between the risk profile and the smart meter data. There was a big correlation between actually their bill payment history on their core energy bill and their bad debt, their propensity for bad debt. So that hypothesis, going back to my earlier point about proving, disproving hypotheses, we were a long way off, but we did find something very interesting about the bad debt rating. So it's not always obvious which data is the right data. Another one, which is a study we did a little while back at Tau, where we were looking at supermarket data and lining that up to some of our policy data. There was a really interesting thing. There were lots of really interesting things out there. Some of them are unexplainable. But this one caught my eye, that 20% of people who'd filled out on their underwriting applications that they were not smokers were then going down to, whether it was Woolies, I can't remember which one it was, and buying cigarettes. That's interesting, isn't it? Nothing we can really do about it, though. That data was all aggregated. We couldn't see to an individual. Obviously, there's privacy laws around that. We can't go out and start surveying people, and do we start building that into our risk premium, etc.? Not a lot we can necessarily do with it. Really interesting potential insight. We also don't know. Maybe they were buying it for their friends. Maybe they just do the weekly shop and get it for friends, their wife, whatever. Who knows? But you've got to be really careful, I guess, around the promise of how great this data might be, but actually how useful it actually is once you get to playing with it. So on that basis, we're very much focused, I guess, on first-party data rather than third-party data. We already have a lot of data in the industry, so let's try and get a proper understanding of that first. So we're going to talk about machine learning, and this is where it comes back to. Everyone's worried it's going to steal all our jobs, okay? So we've already talked about underwriting. The other big one that you highlighted at the start was, we talked about customer service. So the other one you highlighted was underwriting, and that's probably one of the big early areas. It's certainly not the only one, but it's interesting that you've called it out on the poll. There is this threat, this everyone's talking about it, this buzz that it's going to steal our jobs, right? So let's just play with that a little bit. Our experience is that the hype is an awful long way away from the reality. And that's very simple for the reason that machine learning is only good as the data that it's based on. Just like actuaries, the machine needs good data, okay? That's what it's going to need to work off. As we all know, I don't know about you guys, but I have never worked in an organization with 100% data, okay? There's always typos in the forms. There's always agents who write things with different annotations. There's always missing data fields. There's also two different systems with conflicting data. All of these things happen in every organization, certainly every big organization that I've ever worked in. And that automatically makes it very hard for a machine to learn when there's gaps, there's conflicting data, there's missing data, or it's typos and it's gobbledygook. That's really tough. Another one, I had to put a graph in for you lot. There are always edge cases. So machine learns by vast quantities, vast volumes of data. So in the middle of a bell curve, it's happy. There's loads and loads of cases it can learn and really understand what's going on. When you get to the edge of that, when you get to these edge cases where there's only a handful of cases come through over long periods, it's not got enough data to learn off. And that means it doesn't know. It's just too complex, too difficult. It doesn't have the answer. There's also bias. So we talk about bias. I came across an example the other day that one of the consultancies had published around AI that had been trained to review CVs. So there was to ease the pains of our recruitment colleagues, there was effectively a screening service based on all of past CV applications, who'd been accepted, who hadn't. They put that data in the machine. It learnt what CVs should be then go forward to be accepted. Sounds a really good use case. Sounds like it's going to drive efficiency, all those things. Funnily enough, the machine came out pretty biased towards hiring men, for one thing. But all the traditional things, all of those biases that were baked in because it's just learning off the data of what's gone before. And unless you refactor that data or whatever, you're going to be building in all of the biases that already exist. So you've got to still be really careful about the data set and the things that you're training the machine on. Because otherwise you think you've got this amazing tool that's, you know, comes up with this great answer, but actually it certainly isn't any better, and potentially you've built in systematically bias and those sorts of things that's potentially an even worse problem. So bias is definitely an issue. Auditability is another big issue on machine learning, particularly when we think about underwriting and I guess some of the recent developments with the code and so on about us being able to explain our decisions to customers. How do you explain what the machine has decided? Particularly when the machines don't, it's not a rules engine where the rule says this guy's a smoker and he's got asthma or whatever. This is a machine that says, well, based on the past 20,000 cases I looked at, you're a load 50 or you're an exclusion, you're a decline. Is that good enough as an explanation? I don't know. We'll have to find that one out. But auditability is going to be a real question. But ultimately, all of this comes back to an issue of trust, okay? There's this machine that doesn't necessarily think like us. For us, we know that 2 plus 2 equals 4, and it's easy to build that into a rules engine. When you're dealing with a machine, you're effectively giving it lots and lots of data that shows that 2 and 2 always equals 4. And by that way, it starts to learn. And it actually, because of the volumes of data it can handle, the speed of processing, it can handle far more data and far more complexity than our human brains can. And that's just very hard for us to deal with, okay? It makes this trust of it difficult, particularly with this point about auditability. We can't really audit our decisions either. We say we can, but there's a lot of post-rationalisation is the truth whenever we say, oh, yeah, I made this decision because of X, Y, and part of that might be true. But there's lots of other things going on because our brains handle all the different factors in any specific thing, not least of which all of our experience of years gone by and how we've done things differently. And going back to underwriting, from one underwriter to another, it's not always necessarily consistent because of our experience, right? So we've got to learn to trust this machine and get our stakeholders, our businesses and our customers and the regulator to understand and trust it as well. And that's the big challenge. So despite all of that, we have found some areas that are really rich and fertile ground for machine learning. And I'm going to give you just one example that I can talk about. There's some that are in a more secret space, I guess. But this one is looking at quality assurance in our underwriting process. So pretty much the whole industry traditionally will have a QA team that will QA their underwriting process. And the way that works is you take a random sample of cases, pretty small percentage traditionally, and you review those and you find, you know, any inconsistencies, any training opportunities for underwriters, those sorts of things to try and make sure that standards are being kept. Now, the fact of the matter is, when you've got a QA team doing that, a lot of the time they're reviewing cases that are absolutely fine. There's nothing wrong with them. So you can argue that's a waste of those people's time reviewing cases that there's no problem with. The flip side is there's whatever it is, 90%+ of cases that are not getting checked. I'd be willing to bet that somewhere in those 90-odd percent there's some inconsistencies that wish someone had gone and looked at, right? So what we've done is we've gone out and we've trained our machine on all of the past underwriting cases in our direct business to effectively create a tool for our QA team to prioritise which cases they should look at. So the machine now effectively reviews 100%, so every single case, not 2, 3, 4% of cases, every single case is now being reviewed by the machine, and it prioritises any that are potentially overly complex, so remember those edge cases, but also those that show any inconsistencies from what it would predict. And that means that human QA team, they're still there, they're still doing their jobs, but now they've effectively got a prioritised list from which to work. So rather than picking these random cases, they're now working on what hopefully are always the right cases. And as I say, the machine doesn't always get it right, by definition, for some of the reasons we've mentioned. It's not going to be 100% right all the time, but it's certainly a lot better than a random sample. So a really interesting use case of applying machine learning. And you'll see it's leveraged some of those things, but by triaging, that really takes advantage of the fact it's great at the core volume of cases, the kind of 80-20. So 80% of cases it can handle and push them through and say they're all fine and highlight the 20% or whatever it is that need further review. So those triaging type applications are a really good use case, and still keeping the humans, I guess, to focus on those complex cases. The other thing is, you know, we've learned a lot of this by going out and piloting. So I talked about that team with the data scientists and the people around it. We learned a lot when we went out and we first piloted it with our QA team around the way they go about their work and how best to create a tool that works for them. And it took a few iterations to get something that works for them. And we could have created the model very quickly, but to create something practical that's of value to the business, the only way we're able to find that is by putting it into practice and going out and piloting it with that team. So, as I say, despite all the issues that we've talked about with machine learning, in the right use cases, if you take advantage of some of the things that it's good at, it can be really good at driving consistency. It can be really good at driving speed and really good at driving productivity. So if I think about that QA team, their productivity in terms of the value they're adding by only reviewing, I guess, the cases they should be are really, really high. They've obviously speeded up potentially some of the processes that they're doing. And also it's just driving consistency, both for the customer and obviously for the business. And for people like reinsurers, we now know the level of consistency right across all those applications coming in. So I guess in summary, we're in the view that when we talked earlier about it being job losses and all those sorts of things, it's a far more symbiotic relationship. So yes, we do see roles adjusting, absolutely, for humans. But are they being taken away? No, they're not. This is far more a case of focusing them on the complex cases where machines find it hard, and actually taking away a lot of the more menial manual tasks to enable our staff to focus on the big and the important stuff. So depending on where you read, you'll hear people talking about cobots that are collaborative rather than robots. And I think that's absolutely, certainly for the foreseeable future, where this technology is at. So I am going to finish there. We've done our questions. I'm not sure we need to come back to them. So I'm going to say thank you very much and take any questions. Any questions? Yeah.
Hi. Is that on? Amanda Aitken from the Actuaries Institute, which interestingly also has an acronym AI.
Yes.
I noticed you had a diagram of a multi-skilled team that involved several people. And as an actuary, I noticed that actuary wasn't on that team. Do you see a role for actuaries in that sort of team with the data scientist or as the data scientist?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess there's a couple of points into that question. So one is, I guess, the focus that we're working on. As you've seen, you know, early use cases for us were on underwriting. Equally, didn't have an underwriter in that team. Is what we do have is subject matter experts. So we'll go out and not necessarily engage everybody, but we'll get some friendly ones, whether it be the actuaries, be the underwriters, whatever, and bring them into the process, absolutely. So I think that's one point. The other point is the overlap and can actuaries transition? Absolutely, I think they can. And we've definitely seen it, not necessarily in that team, but there's another team as well in our business where we're definitely seeing actuaries move into more data science type roles. It's definitely a transition in mindset, I think, as much as anything. I think the skills are relatively easy to pick up from what we've seen. But people with the right mindsets, we're definitely seeing that. And I think ultimately the experience that actuaries can bring from the way they think about the industry is really powerful, because the data scientist that we got, for example, originally, I think he'd been at ABC News or somewhere, doesn't necessarily have that experience. And on the one hand, that's great because it brings in fresh thinking and all those great things. But it'd be great if that was balanced, to your point, with some industry knowledge around the way the numbers work.
Hi, Dan. Al Merton, and my name often gets read as AI, even though it's not. Dan, you referred to...
I see a theme here in the questions.
Yeah, well, I had to follow that on. A lot of companies like the idea but struggle with how to get started. And you, I think, talked about ring-fencing the team to get focused. But you still have to change what the business does if it's going to work. How do you get the business people that are going to feel the impacts to sign up? What sort of things go into the business cases, or how do you convince people to start looking at change?
Yeah, it's a very good question, and I think it depends again on the individual, organisation, the culture, and the way that's kind of made up. It's what I can share, I guess, is the way we've approached that challenge. And it goes back ultimately for us. We're very lucky with, I guess, the mindset of our executive team, and particularly our CEO, Brett. He's determined to, I guess, effectively from a customer mindset, but also from a productivity mindset, really get to grips with AI and see if there's real benefit there. And that, you know, we've had his support in setting up this team and having it ring-fenced and doing all those things. So, yes, we've been able to create those pilots in that way, but you're absolutely right, Alan, or Al, as I'll now call you, that it there's still the challenge around how do you then get it to scale? How do you then actually introduce it to the business? And if I take, you know, just the example with Wunderwriter, as I kind of alluded to, that first pass, it wasn't necessarily easy, because even if you've got relatively, you know, you've got the general managers, you've got the heads of who might still be incentivized to obviously improve their function, productivity, speed of processing, consistency, all those are KPIs that are probably somewhere in their goals for the year, and they're going to be supporters. You've still got on the ground, on the team, just natural change resistance. And trying to get people to evolve their working practices. I take Wunderwriter, that was a non-threatening job. Okay, there's no jobs being cut there. All it is a tool for that team to use to help them focus on the right cases. Nevertheless, it still took real time to engage them, to get them comfortable with the tool, to fit in with their working practices, for them to understand the way it worked, take them on the journey, all of those sorts of things were really important, and it took time before we could actually get it really humming in terms of that particular unit. But it's what I guess I would say, that if we hadn't done that, if we tried to do it right up front, we would still be talking about it like everybody else. The ability to ring fence that team, show that it works, and show Brett and the exec team that actually this has got real potential to do a step change, and then do the top down. It's not going to work in every organisation, and for us, we definitely have to evolve as we're looking for scale, but that's the way we've done it. Any others? Very good.
Right. Thank you, Dan, for a really great thought-provoking session, and we've got some small talk then.
It's my favourite bit.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
Just a reminder.